I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, aide-de-camp to General Stanley McChrystal and Navy SEAL Chris Fussell joins us to share psychology, mindset, and leadership lessons from how challenges faced in Iraq can be relevant to countless businesses, nonprofits, and other organizations. Chris, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate you reaching out.
Yeah, it is my pleasure. You know, I came across your work by way of a publicist at Penguin, who I'm publishing a book with. And when they told me about the book that you guys have co-written and the work that you do, I was immediately intrigued because up until now, I don't think we've had anybody from the military or the Navy SEALs here. And when I knew that you were a Navy SEAL, I was like, yeah, I definitely want to have this conversation because I can only imagine what direction it will go. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, your background, and how that has brought you to where you're at in the world and what you're up to?
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with maybe the now and then go back a bit. So first and foremost, I'm a father of two crazy little kids and a husband to a great wife. We live here in Washington, D.C., where our practice is based out of Alexandria, Virginia, so old town Alexandria. When the group is the McChrystal Group. So we've been here for about 3-4 years. So prior to that, I got out of the service in 2012 off active duty, and I had spent about 15 years in the SEAL teams. I went through college, the University of Richmond in Virginia. I grew up in Virginia, and then I grew up as an athlete, which is, maybe, we may circle back to sort of the mindset maybe of the community and whatnot. I grew up wrestling and doing some other sports and whatnot, but that always grew up in that sort of team mentality. So when I graduated college, was sort of looking for the next challenge along those lines. So went into the Navy, got my commission in 1997, and then straight out to the basic training for the SEALs, which is all in Coronado Island in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And so I was there for about a year. And then in 98, came out to the East Coast, and the SEAL teams are you're either in San Diego or Virginia Beach for the most part. So I did the majority of my career, I was attached to SEAL teams on the East Coast in Virginia. And, you know, in the 90s, I was there for about 3 or 4 years before 9/11. We were doing a lot of sort of engagement sort of stuff overseas. I did most of my work in Europe, working with European special operations teams, those sorts of things, but mostly training and relationship stuff. And then after 9/11, obviously the whole world sort of changed. And then the next 10 years or so were a big blur. I spent 10 years of my career basically inside of the Joint Special Operations Command, which is the counterterrorism unit inside of the special operations community. And so that was a really formative part of my career, obviously, which led to a lot of the ideas that we're working on now on the business side. So I spent a few years at the tactical level, you know, working overseas with various units, both between Iraq and Afghanistan, and then sort of moved up to the military is like any other business. You had sort of the frontline folks, the mid managers, and the strategic level folks. And so I spent some time on the ground level, and then lived in the operational world for a bit. And then I had a pretty unique opportunity to go and be General Stan McChrystal, who was then a 3-star general. And he was running all of Joint Special Operations Command, a command that he was in charge of for 5 years, which is pretty unique. So from 2003 to 2008, he ran that whole organization about two and a half times longer than the normal tour. And that was sort of a factor of the fact that we were at such an intense period in the conflict, and his role was so critical that he ended up staying there for quite a long time. So from 2007, 2008, I was overseas, mostly in Iraq, with serving as Stan's aide-de-camp, which is sort of like a chief of staff sort of role, if you think of it in the corporate environment. And then 2008, I left the staff and went to Monterey, California, spent about a little over a year in grad school at the Naval Post Grad School. And then went back into the JSOC community for about another 3 years. And then 2012, left active duty service and joined the group here. And so that sort of brings us up to the current day.
Cool. Cool. Well, it's a lot of interesting stuff here and so many questions that are already starting to bubble up in my mind. But, you know, I want to do something that I've been known to do and something that I like to start with, which is, you know, looking back at sort of formative moments, formative experiences and inflection points early in your life, like when you were growing up. I mean, you mentioned sports, but even before that, that would ultimately lead you down this path. I mean, are there things that you think ultimately, you know, put you in a place where you're destined to become a Navy SEAL?
Wow. Sort of put me on the couch here. Yeah, I guess so. You know, I think like any other, this Navy SEALs is definitely one of those organizations that you join or you try to join for one reason, and then you end up staying for another. You can't really translate to the external community what it's like to be a Navy SEAL or, you know, a kindergarten teacher or a surgeon or any sort of niche environment. You have one concept of what it's going to look like that you're drawn to. And then when you get in there, you realize, okay, this is what it's really like. So I say that because what drew me in was probably, you know, if I want to go back to like formative facts about who I am, you know, I was the youngest of four kids. So I probably had, you know, little kid brother syndrome. You know, we were all competitive athletes. We got competitive, worse and worse as we got younger. So I was, you know, I was decent, but nothing like, you know, the rest of my family in the big picture. And so I probably, you know, early in life was drawn to, you know, the next thing to sort of prove my place in the world, which is not uncommon for, I think, you know, more elite military units. It's a great way for, you know, young sort of alpha driven people to sort of test their mettle against whatever their internal drivers are that make them want to do so. It's not unlike, you know, the 22-year-old extreme parachutist you'll find, or rock climber, or big wave surfer, or, you know, that sort of mentality of there's something going on in those minds that you're drawn to that level of sort of finding your own personal edge. You know, you're solving for some sort of internal equation. I'm no better than the next person when it comes to that, I'm sure.
Okay, so that raises a couple of different questions. I'm glad you brought up the example of big wave surfers, because I'm an avid surfer myself, and I always wonder if those guys have a few screws loose to be able to do that. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no, I it's interesting, like, one person's loose screw is another person's, you know, high performer. So I've certainly, there's probably things about me people would say has loose screws. I think I'm a pretty buttoned up person. I've been around people that I say that person's got a loose screw, but when you look at what they're capable of, you know, big wave surfing is a great example, or, I'm an avid rock climber. I mean, there's folks in that world that certainly push boundaries, but when you see how they do it, you say, you know what, if I was doing that, that certainly would be a loose screw. And when he or she is doing it, they're well within their skill set. They're just finding their own sort of personal envelope they want to explore.
Yeah, without a doubt. So you mentioned this idea of sort of this internal equation, and I'm curious, you know, if you could dissect what yours is. I mean, how would you express it? Like, what would you say it is?
What would I say my what is? I'm sorry.
Your internal equation that kind of drove you into all of this.
That's a good question. I mean, as I graduated college, you know, I'm like any other 22, 23-year-old individual who's, you know, done sort of physical team-based things during their life. And so I said, okay, where's the next outlet there? And where's the next thing that I think is going to sort of challenge me to become my best self in that space? And, you know, I sort of half jokingly say, you know, if you think about the reputation of the Navy SEALs as a, you know, some truth, some myth, you know, there's a lot of truth to the difficulty of the selection process to get through it. That draws in a certain type of person. And, you know, you're definitely, I wouldn't say you have a loose screw, but you are out to challenge yourself as deep as you can. If that's your goal as a, you know, a young person joining the military, that you want to join what publicly is seen as one of the most, you know, elite, difficult, selective units. You want to test yourself. You want to prove to yourself that you're in the 20% that can make it through that sort of training pipeline. So that was probably the, you know, the question I was wrestling with and trying to answer. And, you know, like I said, you go into it with that mentality, you make it through the selection, you pat yourself on the back for about a day, and then you realize, okay, now a whole new wave of life is about to start. And then when you look back 5, 10, 15 years down the road, there's a few step functions that you go through as you go through your career, and they continue as you get older and more senior, as to sort of reevaluating, okay, what is the current thing that's driving me to be part of this community? You know, and 10 years in, you're not there to prove that you're a part of that 20%. Obviously, you are. So mm-hmm. so now you're out to serve some greater mission, or to be part of a really elite fighting unit, or to play a part in sort of geopolitical history, or whatever the case may be. But you're constantly reevaluating what it is that makes you want to be part of the community.
Hmm. Let me ask you this. You know, you mentioned a big part of what drove you was this desire to challenge yourself and push yourself to that level. Do you think that desire to challenge oneself at that capacity is something that can be learned, or do you think it's something that's inherently built into people like you?
Hmm. That's $1 million question, isn't it? I think everyone has some level of it. I would say the majority of people have some level of it. Uh-huh. I think it's probably, I'm not a psychologist, but I think it's probably part of human nature at some level to try to push your boundaries. I think one of the interesting things, and actually one of the unique things about the special operations community, and one of the things we see, I think, as a challenge on the corporate side, is most people really never find a steady sort of outlet and flow in their lives that allows them to tap into that. Most organizations are not designed to allow people to really express and push their own boundaries. It's just, and this is one of the things we try to explore in Team of Teams, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the historic systems post-industrial revolution were designed to optimize for a specific skill set, which is sort of the antithesis of like finding and exploring your own sort of creative boundaries. But what we found in the special operations community, though, even that was part of the ethos of the community, that's definitely the type of individual you attract. The system can still take over, because systems ultimately want to control and be predictable and get the most of one thing or a few things that they know about out of individuals. They're not designed to just allow creative networks to establish themselves and as needed based on the problems they're seeing. And once we were able to put that into the system, obviously it worked exponentially better. Mm-hmm. And I think that creative sort of flair exists in the majority of people, probably not everyone, but I think the real challenge is most people don't have the outlet to feel like their organizations they're in, that's truly tapped into and fulfilling for them.
How do we start to design our own lives to express the boundaries of our creativity or push it to the limits?
You know, for me, I guess I've always had a physical outlet. You know, sort of as long as I can remember, I was on a wrestling mat before I, you know, could tie my shoes, just as I was the youngest of three brothers. So that was just part of my, not really my character, but just part of my personality growing up, was just constant physical outlet. And so that's carried me through to today. I'm 42 years old, but that's a very important part of who I am. Not wrestling anymore, but just a physical expression. That's why I really enjoy rock climbing and, you know, distance running, those sorts of things that allow you to sort of set your own goals and live in your own little space that you can control. So I, you know, I think that's an important part. Most of the people that I know that are have the closest thing to balance and contentment in their life have some sort of physical outlet, and that can be, you know, walking on the beach or going in the mountains or riding a bike or whatever, or just living an active lifestyle. But I do think as humans, I think it's in our nature to have that, that as part of our sort of daily structure. And I think it's something that the modern world allows us to very quickly do away with, because there's so much convenience that you don't necessarily have to have that as an outlet. I think that's a lot of risk, but the beauty is it's also something you control. And then I think we also have a creative side that everybody has somewhere inside of them that they want to tap into. So with our kids are 6 and 4, so you'd really try to explore and make options available to them. Not everyone's a Picasso or a Beethoven, but introduction to art and dancing and music, I think, is really important at a young age. I started playing the piano when I was a little kid, which was a great outlet. And, on and off over the years, it's been part of my life. And now that my kids are old enough to start getting into instruments, I've sort of reintroduced it as part of my sort of daily routine. And it's just a great it's a great outlet. It wakes up a whole different part of your brain. I know for me, I can't sit and play the piano for 30 minutes and also think about, the stress of some contract or, whether I got in a good workout this morning. It's a totally different side of your head, which I think is really important. I think we tend to channel too much energy into just one part of our world. And then I think for me, the fourth component, so between sort of your professional, the physical, creative, and the other is family, which, and these are no particular order, I'd put for me personally, family's the number one priority that I try to focus on and make sure that's in balance. And that can be, your wife and kids or your just a spouse, your partner, your parents, whatever the case may be. That's, that's for me personally, an incredible part of all the other parts of a balanced life for me flow from that. If that's out of order, then there's always going to be stress in the other parts.
Hmm. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit. I really want to talk about Navy SEAL training only because I think for many of us, we're exposed to it, like you said, through a combination of myth and truth. And I guess what I really want to find out is what's myth, what's truth, and what are the mindset and psychological lessons that you've brought into your life from that kind of training, and how can we apply it to ours? So lots of questions in one.
Sure. So what's myth and what's truth? That's always kind of a funny way to approach it. but the, so I'm 5'8", 150 on a good day. I just say that to sound cool. It's more like 145. But so the one myth is that we're all 6'2 and, 210 pounds. They always say when you graduate Budge, you automatically grow 3 inches and 40 pounds. So there's definitely an idea of these, sort of superhuman people. That's not really a necessary component of the community. Never has been. There's no single body type that it demands. You have to have decent physical coordination and capability, and that's kind of the entry point. Everything can be built upon that. The other myth I would say is that we all, especially in the SEAL teams, that we all love the water and we're impervious to the cold. You spend enough time in 53-degree water in San Diego or anywhere around the world, and you develop a healthy respect for what it's like to be near hypothermia. it doesn't make you love getting in cold water by any means, which is another interesting part of sort of what it does for you. Sort of on the reality side is, and this is what's really unique about any special operations community or just elite sort of community, I think, in many different spaces, is the part of the purpose of the training, whether by design or it's just sort of evolved this way, probably a mix of both, is it does an incredible job of teaching people, the people that make it through these programs, what their edges look like, what their natural boundaries are, and then how they function as they get close to that edge. So, to give that some realistic sort of example, like I'm not impervious. No SEALs being is impervious to, hypothermia or, physical exhaustion by staying up for 2-3 days in a row. But I've done that enough, as anybody in the community, we've all done that enough to know, oh, I'm getting hypothermia. Therefore, here's what's about to happen. My mental capacity is about to shut down by about 30%. If I stay like this for another 2 hours, I'm going to be completely useless. I won't be able to manipulate anything with my hands. In another 6 hours, I'm going to shut down entirely. And so I'm now early enough in that cycle that I need to start telling my teammates, hey, I'm on the road to shutting down. I need to warm myself up, or I'm going to be a liability to this, what we're doing right now, in about 2 hours, which is a pretty unique part of all that. The same thing goes for mental exhaustion. You develop the ability to recognize, okay, I've been up for too long. I'm about to start making, or I'm currently making, unsound decisions. And because everybody's been through that level of sort of rigor in the training, and everybody's been on that edge before, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, fellas, I've been up for 48 hours. There's probably just pure dribble coming out of my mouth right now. So let's take what I'm saying with a grain of salt, or I need to step back and shut it down for 6 hours because I'm no longer value added to what we're trying to solve for here. And that's probably one of the lesser understood realities of that type of training, what it does for you and your own understanding of how you operate physically and mentally.
Let me ask you this. What pushes people to their breaking point and causes them to quit?
It's a subset of those, of that second half is, there's lots of factors. But, you know, it's rarely the intensity of a specific event. It's the anticipation of how bad the next event is going to be. So I give you an example. Like, there's plenty of books out there or documentaries around SEAL training or other sorts of special operations training pipelines. And if you watch them with any sort of nuanced eye or read the materials that are out there, rarely is it on some road march in the Ranger Regiment where you've got a 80-pound ruck and you're 12 miles into a 20-mile sort of endless thing, is someone going to raise their hands and say, I quit? Same thing with the SEAL selection process. Very rarely, as I was going through it, was there, were we in the middle of a swim and somebody just raises their hand and say, hey, it's too cold, it's too long, I'm out of here, or the sand is just too soft today, I can't keep running. Most people, if they drop out during that, it's because of an injury that they just can't sustain anymore. Most people will finish the event, and then, you get an hour to recharge and get some other gear ready, boom, 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 and now it's 10 at night, it's getting colder, and the next task is to do the same swim in the dark or whatever. You know you can do it. You just did it. You have the physical capability. You know the water isn't any colder. But the idea of having to go back in and do it again, and the uncertainty that when we finish that one, is there going to be yet another one? Because part of the idea that the way these sort of selection programs work is a certain amount of mystery around what's next and what's next. So the fear of the unknown really becomes a mental blocker. And so you know you have the capability to deal with the cold and the stress and the physical requirements. But people tend to get on these long time horizons and they fear the second or third thing that's far out of their control. And so it's those in the gaps in between when they have that time to really reflect on the unknown is when they'll sort of quietly walk off to the side and say, hey, I'm not going out to the next evolution. There's very rarely did I see a sort of a dramatic person quitting, right in the middle of something. It's usually just off to the side and they just don't show back up for the next thing you're required to do. And I think it selects for – I think this is really important skill in life is there are times when you have to think on a long time horizon. Mm-hmm. And there are times when it is good to keep your focus really on a short time horizon. It's true in the military. I think it's true in other areas of life. And to be able to toggle between those is a learned skill. And that's one of the reasons that athletes tend to do better than average in high selection special operations communities because you grow up realizing from a very early age, without any sort of conscious thought on it, that you toggle between short and long time horizons. So, you don't go into, day three of practice when wrestling season starts and you're sort of out of shape and the coach is mad and it's a really hard practice and you just get you get whipped up on by somebody else on the team. You don't think, wow, this is going to be, 6 months of this. It's going to be like this every day. I just can't do it. Some people do. And then they sort of naturally attrit themselves out of that level of competition. And the people that are hardwired to be able to toggle say, that was a really bad practice. It's day three. Tomorrow's going to be better. I'm going to get some rest tonight. And they come back and they do a little bit better the next day. And it's a really important skill, not just in the military, but I think in life.
Wow. Okay. So this has been my favorite part of the conversation, because this is the stuff that I really want to talk about, is taking sort of these mindset lessons from your SEAL training and applying them to our lives. You mentioned a couple of things in that last bit where you talked about sort of finding our boundaries, learning to function at edges and managing fear. And I'm interested in how we start to bring those lessons into our lives without necessarily having to go through SEAL training.
I think everybody does some version of this. Anyone that's successful anywhere has got some sort of process that they're doing with how conscious it is. I don't know. I mean, the advantage of something like SEAL training is you are forced. Most people are forced to find that edge. Like, if you've been awake for 4 days and you're freezing cold, and somebody's telling you at 2 a.m. to go sit in 55-degree water, there's no rational part of your brain that says, "Oh, that's a great idea. I would be doing that if you weren't here anyway." So I'm forcing myself to fight through basically every level of rational thought that my brain wants to throw at me right now. And so that's sort of a reflective thing that stays with you for a long time. But I think, and lots of sort of competitive spaces have some part of that that those that come up inside of it develop over time. So I think, in other spaces, I'll give you an example where I see things like this and that some people can control for and some have a difficult time handling would be, so imagine you're an up-and-coming, VP or whatever in a big organization, and your opportunity to, pitch your boss on the next big project or something like that, which, some things that are pretty common like that. So you see people get buried in sort of the fear of the unknown of what if the pitch doesn't go well? What if I don't get this position? What if I get it and it doesn't go well? What if I get halfway through and the project team doesn't think I'm capable of it? We all have these sort of inner voices that tell, fill us with fear and doubt, and it's human nature. And it's one of our, I think, humanity wide, one of the big sort of anchors that we all put on ourselves are these sort of inner voices that, not to get too kooky about it, but they go back to our, our childhood or our early experiences coming up where you were never fast enough or smart enough or likable enough in junior high, whatever the case may be. And that whether people admit it or not, there's part of that voice that's whispering in their ear when they walk into the boardroom to, as a C-suite exec. So I think really understanding yourself and developing an awareness around, hey, I'm always going to have this little voice that thinks I'm X, Y, and Z. But in reality, I've done projects in the past and been successful at them. I've built teams and I've had mostly positive feedback from the team members. I'm being asked to pitch for this next position based on a track record of success. So let me focus on the near term thing, which is I've got a boss that says for whatever reason he thinks I'm a capable person to walk in and vie for this next position or this next project. And that's my immediate thing that I'm going to solve for. I'm not going to think about, the little voice in my head that's saying 6 months from now I might have a failing project and a team that doesn't like me. But that's hard, because that's a really deep part of all of our psychology.
There's more of my conversation with Chris after this short message from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by freeshipping.com. Saving money when you shop online doesn't have to be complicated. Scouring the internet for discount codes and other things can be really time consuming, and half the time the codes don't even work or have expired. I've wasted a ton of time myself on things like this. But with a subscription to freeshipping.com, you can not only shop at a bunch of retailers you know and love, but you get 10% cash back, free shipping, and free returns on every purchase. And you get the 10% cash back on top of other coupons and savings. You get free shipping rebates without a minimum order amount, and there's over 1,000 retailers you can choose from, including Best Buy, Walmart, Target, and Lowe's. And you can buy just about everything, including clothing, books, electronics, and more. So you can save at all the retailers you normally shop at and even discover new ones. So let's say you want to buy a high-ticket item like a PlayStation or even a home appliance like a television or a refrigerator. You get free shipping and 10% cash back on it. And for being an unmistakable creative listener, you'll get $15 in a free trial to kickstart your savings. So go to freeshipping.com/creative. That's freeshipping.com/creative to start your savings with $15 in a free trial. Now, back to my conversation with Chris. I would imagine that with your training, a good amount of what you've learned is how to make decisions rather quickly. And this came actually from my business partner. He said, I sent him a text saying, hey, I'm talking to a Navy SEAL. Anything you want to know? He said, yeah. He said, can you ask him how to make decisions quickly and how to recover from setbacks quickly?
Yeah, I think in the, you know, you definitely, Navy SEALs don't have a, you know, the corner on this market for sure. you can look at, I think on a team level, there's a whole sort of, there's a developing school of thought being pioneered by a professor called Preston Klein, who we talk about in we reference some of his work in Team of Teams. He's up at Wharton, and he's done some really interesting studies on mission-critical teams. So that's sort of one aspect to it that's maybe worth diving into. And then there's the individual level as well. So you think of a surgeon, in a high-risk sort of intense environment. I mean, that surgeon has she has a team around her of supporting staff, but she also has herself in the moment. So, and same thing on a mission critical team, like a SEAL team or a group of firefighters that are rushing into a building or something like that. So the question is, making fast decisions and then recovering from errors. I think what those, if you live your life in that sort of environment, like I'll use a SEAL team as an example, because that's what I know. You do develop, the best leaders I saw developed an inherent ability to quickly sort of triage information. And this was true at the tactical level, operational level, strategic level. And some were better at different, at triaging at different levels better than they were at others. So by triaging, I mean, at the tactical level, the ability to quickly say, okay, we have, here's the situation. We have this number of operators on the ground. We have an enemy threat that way. Here are my supporting assets that I can call to the fight. If we have to get out of this situation, we're going to go this way or this way. Here's what threats that the enemy has that they can present upon us. And then as things shift, if there's a, they can quickly triage between, okay, there's what we're doing now has caused some sort of local problem set over here. So there's maybe civilians gathering on the other side of the city. And I also now see that the threat we're facing, they're moving in some sort of heavy weapon system. So that can all be overwhelming information because it is sort of, three-dimensional chess in some ways. But the best tactical leaders that I saw, and I certainly would not put myself in that tier. I mean, there's some folks that are just amazing in those environments. They can quickly say, and they wouldn't consciously, talk about it like this in the moment, but they just know that threat to my right, the gathering civilians, I'm not worried about that. I've got 5 to 10 minutes to deal with that. This heavy weapons system, major problem. What assets do I have that can deal with it? Is it guys on the ground? Is it overhead assets, et cetera? Or do we have to move my position? And quickly just sort of live in the flow of that moment. And they're constantly racking and stacking, different data points inside their head and flowing their organization to in response to it. So some of it is similar to how, an NFL quarterback, there's a great book called How We Think. Mm-hmm. And it talks about Tom Brady on a 2-minute drive and the number of decisions, if you broke it down second by second, that he made as quarterback in that drive. It's just off the charts. The reads that they're making every single moment, reading complex defenses and nailing the decision points. Now, if probably in the moment, if you just ask to go back and say, sketch out the decisions you made in that 2 minutes, there might be 7 things on the piece of paper. But he's far exceeded the 10,000 hour rule and he just lives in the flow of the moment. Uh-huh. And I saw that, similar things at an operational level or a strategic level. I spent most of my career really in that sort of operational section and certainly wasn't a master of it, but developed some ability to say, okay, we're on a complex battlefield trying to coordinate between different units and quickly be able to rack and stack, we're on this pretty tight, a lot of the times in Iraq, tight 24-hour sort of cycles of missions. And you could look at different sets of variables and inputs coming off of, intelligence reports and our forces moving around, et cetera, and be able to sort of triage your factors and say, okay, based on these 3 things don't really matter. These 2, I need answers on right now within the next hour, if we're going to make the right decisions in the next mission cycle. These 3 are below my level, I'm going to hand that down to the tactical guys. They can solve for it. And if you have the folks that developed that ability, wasn't always perfect, but they tended to trend toward right on any given cycle. And if you sat back and watched what they were doing, they were constantly running through a mental checklist. But again, they would have a hard time articulating it in the moment. The best thing I always found was just sort of observe them and see what got their immediate attention, what got pushed to the right, and what got pushed down. And that's where I was able to learn the most from them.
Wow. So you mentioned that you had an opportunity to both work on the ground and strategically. And I'm curious what you learned about working on the ground from working strategically and what you learned about working strategically from working on the ground.
Yeah, so I'd say, the military, we talk about tactical, operational, and strategic levels of the organization. Tactical is, I'm an operator on the ground, out on a mission, exchanging fire with the enemy, that sort of thing. That's everyone's sort of Hollywood version of
right.
Operational is, the guy in the headquarters with the headset on and sort of moving forces around, or, in the business world, this is sort of mid-management. but it's cooler than that. And then the strategic level is, SVP and C-suite. So in the military, that's your, colonels and general officers, one star, two star, that sort of thing. Now Hollywood has this sort of classic version of how it gets more and more dysfunctional as you get more senior, and the guys in the field hate the guys at the headquarters, and the guys at the headquarters think the strategy guys are a bunch of idiots, blah, blah, blah. It's not really like that. I mean, there's elements of that you develop different understanding at different levels, but what made the Joint Special Operations work so well, one of the components was what we called shared consciousness, a level of understanding between the operator on the ground and the most senior leaders, in our world, the 3 and 4 star level that were, the folks that were talking to the Secretary of Defense or the President on a regular cadence. And so it was very unique for a distributed organization. I mean, we were thousands of people around the globe, but if it mattered, the junior tactical level operator would have access to understand what was going on at the most strategic tiers inside the organization, so that their nightly sort of decisions that they were making on the battlefield were informed by that. Because we, obviously as a force, you put that level of forces in a very very strategic positions on a pretty regular cycle. So you want the most level of what we call, like I said, shared consciousness inside the force, so that the tactical level decisions can be guided by what matters at a strategic level. Now, what I learned as I moved up that was, I came into the organization in 2003 as McChrystal had just taken over JSOC. So if I sort of truncated my career, I spent 6-7 years or so sort of in the tactical world. Decent experience, but most of my formative experience happened at the operational level. And the sort of pie chart of where you spend your career varies for everyone. It's just sort of a lot of it's fate and where you end up at different times. At the operational level, I was able to spend time in a few different theaters, really seeing how that's your mid-management, and I happened to be there at the right point where McChrystal was really opening up the communication between the strategic and the tactical. And if you were well-positioned and you timed it right, you got to sit right in the middle of this amazing flow and see how all of this was being coordinated now as this broad network of everyone had equal access to information at all the time. And your job as that mid-level operations person was to ensure that the communication and the network was working, rather than the traditional mindset, which was in any organization, when I'm mid-level management, I incentivize to make sure that the system works. So I own the book. So there's a book on how we're going to do this. I own the book, and I'm going to make sure everybody's doing the right thing at the right time, because I've learned the process, and I'm going to make sure we're doing it right, in hopes that eventually I'll be at the strategic level and I can write the book. And so what we learned at that operational level was the book is dated. The book, it does not work anymore. And so we got to throw the book out, and we have to redesign the system in real time. And at that mid-level operations management system isn't open-minded and constantly helping to rewire our network system that we were creating, then it was going to stagnate. So that was pretty amazing for me. And then I was never a strategic level leader, but the exposure I had to it was at really that year when I was working as General McChrystal's aide de camp a year in Iraq, watching him run the senior level staff of our organization, which at that point, like I said, was spread around globally, and then interact with all the other strategic leaders on the battlefield, military, civilian, and then back in the United States. And you know, as an aide, you're a few feet from the principal for the whole year, so you get to really, you don't have a functional role in making any decisions, but you get to sort of immersed in how that communication happens. So I was very fortunate to be able to see it at all three levels.
Wow. So one idea that you brought up in that whole monologue was this idea of shared consciousness. And I'm interested in how we bring shared consciousness into the teams we work on and build high trust teams outside of the military and outside of SEALs, like in our own lives and in the work that we're doing.
Yeah. No, I think it's really important in today's world. I mean, so something about back up a little bit. Our belief on the battlefield in about, and I say our belief, I mean, McChrystal was the first person to really start this conversation, but then trickled out quickly inside of our part of the special operations community and then eventually beyond that, was this. Somewhere around late 2003, early 2004 in Iraq, McChrystal was the first person at the senior leadership level to stand up and say, hey, I think we're actually losing this war. We are getting outmaneuvered, outpaced, on sort of any way you look at it, by the Al-Qaeda threat in Iraq. And we know we have the best operators, the best helicopters, the best, all these other sort of variables that they can't compete with. And we know that whenever we get to the right place in the right time, we win in the moment. All that being said, they're still outmaneuvering us, and they're gaining territory, and they're increasing their numbers, even while we're winning in all these small little pockets. Therefore, there's a systems level problem here, which was his basic argument going into it, which is we need to back up and look at how we function as an organization. Because I know the problem isn't that we have skilled operators on the ground or amazing helicopter pilots or communication systems. The problem is we're not moving information and decisions fast enough to be able to compete with the speed of an organic network that is Al-Qaeda. So how do we scale the effectiveness of that small team, that, you know, SEAL troop or army unit or whatever the case may be? How do we scale that up onto the enterprise level? And which is where Team of Teams, the title, became. We started to use that language. We have to expand up that model and really be an interconnected global team of teams to make this work. So that, fast forward a few years, at the end of it, we were a bit of a hybrid system where we had not done away with the org charts on the wall. So we still retained the strength and discipline of a hierarchical system, because, you know, any organization, at least in today's period in history, needs a way to do payroll and hire people and train people and communicate along linear sort of functionalities. In the military, that's how you train soldiers and deploy them. That's how you buy aircraft carrier, whatever the case may be. But on a night-to-night basis in the fight, in places like Iraq or Afghanistan or other places, we were a interconnected network of individual nodes or individual teams that could quickly cross hierarchical boundaries between verticals that in the old system would have been separated. So you no longer had to go up with information across for decision and back down to the other side. You could just quickly connect cross-functionally throughout the network. So the components that we talk about, shared consciousness is one of four key elements. So we started in writing Team of Teams, and now reflecting back on the experiences there, we spent quite a few years since we've all gotten out, really trying to break down what made that system work. So at the team level, we talk about two main drivers. You have to have high levels of trust between individuals, both in a perfect world, you trust them as an individual, like I'll trust you to watch my kids, but also trust the information you send me, that it's going to be accurate. I know you will go to the best of your abilities. You will not send me inaccurate information. Therefore, I will move on it quickly when I receive it and not try to double check your homework. And then a common purpose amongst the team. So you know why you're here and what your purpose is in life. So our goal was to scale those two drivers onto the organizational level. And we knew to do that, we had to create this idea of shared consciousness, which is how do you create this broad understanding of the right information at the right time. So at the small team level, people can finish each other's sentences. how do we get that at, you know, at a global enterprise level? And we knew if we could get that in place, we would get to the fourth and arguably the most critical end state driver, which is this idea of empowered execution, where you now, if you're that tactical level person, you have enough strategic context that you can move with, and you are held accountable to move with high levels of speed and accuracy on a very autonomous and independent cycle. And so to beat the speed variable, we knew not everybody can ask for approvals about every little thing, which is the incentive system in the traditional sort of hierarchy. We need people to just swim in this information and know that they're empowered and expected to take action when the timing is right. And so when we combined all of those variables, that's when the flywheel really started to turn inside of the special operations community. So on the business side, I think all of those, our thesis coming out was, this applies to many other sectors. This is not unique to the battlefield. And here's why we believe that to be the case. Because this, as I said earlier, despite the fact that we had great helicopters and great operators and all these comparative variables that were much better than the force we faced, something's equalizing the problem here, because they're way better and faster than terrorist organizations were just 15, 20 years ago. The differentiator is we're in the information age. So everyone can now push and receive data as quickly as anyone else. First world does not solve for that problem anymore. There's no superior economic system that can allow you to move information faster than a distributed network like ISIS. And so we underestimated how much of an impact that was going to have. And we spent years sort of redesigning our system to account for it. So our theory of the case was, if that's true, then obviously everybody's in the information age. So every enterprise is probably dealing with some version of this problem, which is, how do big traditional organizations adapt to the speed of the current environment that the information is sort of layered on top of all of us, whether we like it or not? And so I think in this industry, a lot of the same solutions, and that's what we do now in our group, a lot of the same solutions in principle apply. And so you have to be willing to push an organization away from just the traditional org chart more toward this hybrid system where it's allowed to flow like a network when needed. And so we really believe in pushing along two sort of vectors, one being the processes that drive the organization, sort of throwing the rule book out a little bit and communicating with much broader swaths of the organization on usually a faster cadence than most organizations are find themselves in today's world. And include, the faster you get, the more people you want to include in the conversation. And so at our peak, when I was Stan's aide de camp, we did a daily synchronization meeting, a global video teleconference, which would have 7,000 to 8,000 people on the net listening in real time to get that strategic level context. That was sort of the backbone of shared consciousness. And then if you're going to, as you move an organization further and further down that line, you also have to develop the second vector is, do you have the leadership behaviors in place that support that shift? And so you're creating a much more inclusive, sort of radical transparency-based organization. And so your traditional C-suite behaviors aren't necessarily established to support communicating with thousands of people every day in real time about things that you don't know. So once what we found was we were moving along both those vectors in constant iteration, and that's what I believe in organizations. If you can get those two things moving toward a much more network-based, information age sort of system, then you can get there in any space.
Wow. I have two last questions. One is sort of silly, but I'm just curious what the difference is between the reality that you experience, being face to face, in something like special operations, and the one that we experience through the media of seeing what, is told on the news about places like Iraq. Like, what's different about how you guys experience and what are we not seeing, and what can you actually talk about, and what are you not allowed to talk about?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think one of the, I'd say what I saw in my younger sort of part of my career, you have your first sort of epiphanies on that difference. And our generation hadn't been to war yet, so that's a radically different thing. And what I when I would watch what was going on and watch the way that it was portrayed in the US or globally through the media, I sort of started to look at it like this, and this is not a perfect analogy, but in some ways it's like, you know, putting a like a mini cam on, you know, the toe of the center's shoe in a football game, and that's your only optic into the football game, and then trying to accurately report about, you know, what's going on. So you hear a little bit in the huddle, you know when the snap is gone, you kind of know when the play is over. You might have an idea if it was a run or a pass, and you can see yourself advancing up the field, you know, if you're on offense or defense. But there's a thousand other things that you have no idea of. And so you try to piece it together. And so I would, when I would come home and sort of hear the media's reflections on what had just happened on the last deployment or whatever, it's not a great analogy, but that's sort of how I felt. It's like, okay, you know there's a game going on, and you kind of know which way the ball's moving, but it's way more complex to try to explain it. And so, you know, part of that's driven by the fact that we're all addicted to this 24-hour news cycle. And so I don't blame any one sector, be it media or consumer or political, whatever the case may be. We're all swimming in this right now, and it's part of this thing of how do we deal with the fact that there's so much information available. And our reaction right now, I think we'll eventually solve for this, but our reaction right now is just report on everything all the time, whether it's accurate or not, and there's some sort of 24-hour competition going on to both report and consume information. And so you run the risk of everybody, all of us, sort of being collectively wrong, mostly wrong all the time about these really complex problems. So that's one of the sort of misperceptions. I guess the other one is, and as a former, you know, active duty member of the military, there's maybe a misperception about how most people see the battlefield, which is, you know, war sucks. And that's why, you know, when people go back into, you know, you see former military politicians, they tend to be labeled oftentimes as the more conservative, thoughtful, let's make sure we have all the information straight. And they'll, you know, some of them get labeled as, you know, they're hedging their bets and they're too scarred by their experiences, et cetera, et cetera. I think the reality is, you know, people that have been over and seen conflict up close and personal realize that it destroys things. You know, unfortunately it's a necessary part of, you know, how the world exists as we currently know it. But most people I know that have spent extended periods in combat, they're not warmongers, you know, because you see what it does to cultures, to families, to, you know, non-combatants, to soldiers, near-term, long-term effects. It's a bad reality of our, you know, of humanity. It doesn't mean I wouldn't support going into war in the future, because sometimes it just has to happen. But I think we have this collective misperception that it's some sort of clean thing with a start date and an end date, and you do it and then you win and then you put in the new thing and da-da-da-da. We've come to some sort of understanding like that as we see that, okay, we're basically fit in the middle of an infinite game, arguably in certain regions around the world. But still, you know, there's a perception like, well, we wanted to end, therefore we're going to withdraw and not get engaged. Well, it's not going to end whether we're there or not, you know. And it didn't start because we showed up. We probably accelerated a lot of things. But these are sort of endless realities of how, you know, how humanity tends to interact with one another. And so I think one of the misperceptions is that we can go in and fix within 2 to 3 years or 10 years, and here's the exit plan and the end state we're going to reach, and da-da-da-da. You don't control that. There's so many multidimensional variables. You choose to participate or not, and you can try to trend it in the right direction, but decisive end states don't really exist in these sorts of conflicts.
Wow. Well, Chris, this has been really, really interesting. A lot of profound lessons in psychology and mindset, which is really what I was hoping for. So I want to finish with my final question, which is how we finish all our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
What makes someone... I think it's... my impression has been when you see someone who's who hits their sort of flow state, and this is actually pretty interesting to think about, because you see it a lot in the military and business, or any high, probably anywhere in life where, you know, that tends to attract sort of driven high performers. If you're wired like that as a person, so you're smart, you're energetic, you're charismatic, whatever, all these things that sort of tend to give people, you know, a one up in life. I think early on, some people, and we've all seen this, say, I've got all these skills. I want to, and society tells me the thing I should, that's cool, is to be a physician or to be rich or to be a politician. So these early formative experiences tend to, you know, put people on this track. And if they have all the advantages, they're smart and they go to good school, et cetera, they can do that. You can become a congressperson, or you can become a physician, or you can be a Navy SEAL. But oftentimes people hit their stride and they realize, this is not really what I'm hardwired to do. There's a lot of things about being a physician or a politician that I just don't like, but now I'm in it and I'm just going to make the best of it. And, you know, at a certain point, I think that tends to catch up with people. Unmistakable people that I've encountered are ones whose, and not everyone gets this out of the gates, but it's when their natural strengths and capabilities, their intellect, their personality, what their sort of that creative, emotional, family index all points them toward, that they end up in a profession that allows all of those to be expressed. I think that's when you find the most unmistakable people, where you say, wow, this person's not only incredibly talented in this space, but this is clearly who they're supposed to be in life. And it's unique for people to like just get on a track and end up there. You know, that's a pretty long shot. That's why I think, you know, life is getting longer. It's a more complex world than it's ever been. So I always encourage people, you know, it's never too late to shift. And so if you've developed all these great skill sets being a banker, but you find out that making a lot of money isn't really what drives you, quit. You know, it's a long life. Go. What are your skill sets? What really makes you passionate? Go do that, because the opportunity's out there. I think way too many people spend their lives in fear of the unknown, of making a big shift midlife. And I've done it. It's one of the most rewarding decisions I ever made. I can imagine not espousing for the rest of my life.
Awesome. Well, Chris, this has been great. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share some of your insights and your story with our listeners at the Unmistakable Creative.
It's been fantastic. Great discussion. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to the Unmistakable Creative.